All right. I'm recording now.
So am I.
I'm the one who records.
I record it.
Walter White Knox, I record. Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex. With me is James.
Hello.
Oh, okay. Glad you could chime in. Just wanted to say a few things before we get into our episode. Be sure to check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. We have all kinds of other content. Last week we put out an audio podcast on The Dark Knight Rises. Tomorrow or Thursday we'll have a podcast up a video podcast up on Drive. And I mean, we've got so many other video podcasts up now, as well as audio podcasts. We also write pop culture criticism every week. So yeah, be sure to check that out and follow us on Twitter at the MacGuffin Men. All one word, no underscores, nothing like that. And it's MacGuffin spelled MacGuffin. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/themacguffinmen. You can search for us on Pinterest. We're not there, but you can search. Maybe it'll be fun for you. It's a good way to kill some time. But yeah, I feel like that's pretty much it. James, did I forget anything?
You forgot our Pinterest offshoot, MacGuffinterest.
Oh yes. Okay. Yeah.
So we're not on there, but you can look for us.
You can Google it and then be confused as to why it doesn't exist. Except for the reasons that we were explaining it, because it doesn't exist. Anyway, let's hit the theme song, shall we?
Now that we got the serious stuff out of the way.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. This episode is brought to you by The Grey. It's just like Dances with Wolves, but with less dancing and more awesome. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, so we're back. We're back from the theme song.
I can still hear it echoing a bit.
Yeah, okay. So what are we talking about here today, James?
We are talking about a movie.
Okay. A stretch for us.
Not a color.
Okay.
The Grey.
Oh.
not to be confused with the color.
I got a, you know, dressed for the occasion. I'm wearing a plain gray t-shirt. Which people that know me will know that's very out of character for me.
Yeah, you're more of a neon pastels kind of guy.
Really? Yeah, I really am. Yeah.
No, we're talking about The Grey, which, if you don't know, is a 2012 movie.
Yep.
Directed by Joe Carnahan.
Yep.
Starring Liam Neeson.
Also, yep.
Yes. And in a nutshell, it's about Liam Neeson fighting wolves.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah, on the surface at least. Uh-oh. Getting deep in this one.
Yeah, a little bit.
No, in all honesty, there was more to this movie than I thought.
Yeah, I think there was more to this movie than everybody that saw it thought. Yeah. Because it was really, the way this movie was discussed before it was released, the way I discussed it, the way the trailer made me think it was Taken with Wolves. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I don't mean that like a play on Dances with Wolves, although I guess it kind of works. I mean it like he's going to throat strike some wolves like he did in the movie Taken with People. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. So. Oh, I have plenty of throat striking puns to get.
And it was released in the same, around the same weekend, same part of the year that Taken was released when it came out in 2010. Is that the year? No, that seems way too late. 2009 probably. But yeah. And Liam Neeson did Unknown, which was kind of tagged as a Taken movie last year as well. And that same
thing. Yeah, I was going to say Unknown was kind of like, let's just continue the Taken thing that seems to be working. So
poster was so similar to the Taken poster.
Yeah. And so it didn't seem like much of a stretch. And I mean, Liam Neeson had just been on this action kick, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. He has been for a while.
And so it kind of just made sense that, you know, this is just going to be an action, and to use one of your favorite words, thriller. but up in the Arctic somewhere, and game on. Wolves versus Liam Neeson.
Yep.
Fight.
Yep.
See what happens. It is kind of that.
Yeah, it is. I mean, from the 15-minute mark on, there's a constant threat of wolves at all times. And that is, you know, one of their main concerns outside of just general death. You know, they're worried about death by wolves.
Specifically by wolves.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're right, though. I was surprised by how this started, though. Like, right off the get-go, it was heavier than I expected.
Yeah, it was.
I mean, we get a, I don't want to say suicide attempt, but on the brink of suicide in what, like 4 minutes?
Yeah. So oh, yeah, definitely. And I mean, the very beginning of the movie, the voiceover is him writing a suicide note, is it not?
So. Yeah, it's, yeah, I mean.
Or something like that.
Yeah, it's him writing a letter to his, it's never really defined, ex-girlfriend, ex-wife, romantic interest. And yeah, just kind of how he's, you know, at the end. And, you know, even his description of his life, I mean, the first few lines are, yeah, just dark and very, very depressing. And he's talking about how he's at the end of the world with all these people who aren't fit for mankind. And puts his, you know, rifle in his mouth and then hears the cry of a wolf and at least temporarily decides that life is worth living.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's pretty intense. I love that opening 5 minutes. So I think it's really, really good.
Yeah, it's good. And, you know, as we said, it really sets the tone right off the bat that this isn't just going to be a, you know, a shoot 'em up goofy action movie.
Yeah.
Even though I think there are things that don't work in this movie.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, they at least attempt to do something, you know, deeper than that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you think it works or not, there is at least an attempt there to have something a little bit more to this.
And even in general, like, I find this movie, I found was just so visceral and did, like, the parts that work so well, I think, as far as the action sequences. Like, the plane crash is crazy.
Yeah, this is... all jokes aside, well, actually, first, I hated the movie Knowing. We both saw that movie, right?
Knowing. Oh, yeah, the Nicolas Cage one. Sorry. Yeah.
Yes.
I'm sorry that I failed you there.
Yeah. Awful, awful movie. One of the worst endings to any movie.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. Knowing wasn't an awful movie. It had an awful ending.
There is some
parts. It wasn't a good movie.
Okay, It certainly was never a good movie. But the plane crash and that, I thought, was the best plane crash scene I've ever seen in a movie.
Yeah.
And I'm not kidding about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have a lot of problems with that movie, but that part was amazing.
Yeah.
I thought it looked really, really good. And, yeah, it hits you on that visceral level. And I think this plane crash is up there with it.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I know putting something up there with Knowing usually isn't saying a lot, but that scene is good in Knowing, and the plane crash in this scene, plane crash scene in this movie. Great.
Yeah, put it this way, I'm really happy we're recording this podcast after I got back from taking a plane out west over mountains. You know what I mean? Glad we didn't do this podcast.
I mean, not just that it was very very realistic, and, you know, kind of, I obviously never been in a deadly plane crash, but I imagine that's what it looks like. Also, just the way he's going in and out of consciousness, and you kind of get his dream state and the waking state.
Yeah.
You like that a lot, right?
Oh, yeah. Love it. Those two shots, like the when he's asleep and then gets waken up by the turbulence that ends up turning into the plane crash, where he's just sort of lying in bed and then just gets pulled up. I just love that. Like, just, I assume, you know, he's just on a harness and they just yank him away. I think that's so great. And the same thing happens when he wakes up after the plane crash. He gets pulled off to the side this time, and the snow starts to fall, and it's so, like, just the look of it is so simple. Like, I can instantly break down how it was done.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, with a pretty good guess, I could figure out how it was done, because it just looks simple, but it's just so quick, and it just hits so hard, and it just works, and it's just such an effective shot that looks really cool. You know?
Yeah, and I thought maybe, how many times do you see this?
I've seen it 3 times now.
Okay, so I just saw it once very recently. I thought it was the wife getting kind of pulled away out of the bed, not in him staying in place, but I'll take your word for it if you've seen it more. But yeah, and it's just because it just happens so quickly. I mean, they're comfortable in that bed, and then she just, like, they get ripped away from each other, and, you know, he's back in this awful, awful reality of this plane crash in Alaska.
Yeah, although what you said about the second one with possibly her getting pulled away, that makes sense to me as well. I feel like it could go either way. But
yeah, that is, as you said, it's very quick, but it's very effective. And yeah, that was especially so early on in the movie, right after kind of getting the impression that, oh, okay, this is going to be a heavier movie. and, you know, is giving me a little bit more than I anticipated already. That really cool visual thing that, again, just added to it. I was like, okay, so I really didn't have this movie pegged 100% at all.
Yeah. Which is always a good, like, just in general, yeah. You know, it's always a good feeling. Because then it's sort of like, well, okay, now all these things I thought were going to happen, maybe, you know, I've got them cast in a different light in my head. And, yeah, I mean, I've said it over and over on this podcast that, you know, that's an easier way to get me to like your movie is to do something I don't expect. And to sort of make me feel like this is a movie that I just totally wasn't expecting within the first 15 minutes, you know. That's good.
Yeah. And so we
filmmakers listen. Yeah. Listen
up. Oh, they're listening. Don't worry.
Yeah. All of them.
All of the filmmakers.
Hi, Joe. Anyways, continue.
Yeah. Well, no, actually, that actually was one of the next things I was going to say is this is directed by Joe Carnahan.
Yes.
Which I assume is who you were referencing when you said Joe there.
Actually, it was Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Okay.
But yeah.
We call him Joe.
Yeah, exactly.
What else did Joe Carnahan do?
He did, I guess we'll go in reverse order. We did the A-Team before this. And then I think his movie before the A-Team was Smoking Aces, right?
I think so, yeah.
And then before that was Narc. And he sort of, he's had a lot of things come, you know, go through production hell and also just sort of problems with things he was actually signed on for. Like, he was attached to Mission Impossible 3 in an early stage, and he got kicked off for creative differences. And also, there was this movie, Killing Pablo, I think, which was about Pablo Escobar, that he's had been trying to... I don't know if he's still trying to get it made, but had been trying for a long, long time. But yeah.
IMDb says it's still in... He's still on it and that it's in pre-production, but everything I've seen elsewhere says that it's pretty dicey.
Gotcha.
Yeah, so, I mean, he's coming off A-Team and Smoking Aces.
Mm-hmm. Smoking Aces, which is a terrible movie. A-Team, which is good at being a bad movie.
Okay. Yeah. But those are both pretty, let's say, unrestrained movies.
Absolutely.
If you will, to put it generously.
Yeah. The bear shooting tank in the A-Team is one of the most ludicrous things I've ever seen in a movie. I love that scene so much, but it's insane.
And Smoking Aces is pretty off the wall.
Oh, yeah. It's so insane. It's very, like... It's a Quentin Tarantino movie if Quentin Tarantino switched cocaine for speed. That's what that movie feels like.
That's a good assessment of that, actually. So, yeah, and I think that, you know, coming off that part of his career, I think this also kind of set me up for more of a crazy, goofy action movie.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, as we said, there are some very crazy action parts. I mean, that plane crash is nuts.
Yeah. It is more like it's an action movie, but I think more people would call it a thriller than an action movie. You know?
Yeah, and it is a lot more restrained than those other movies.
And the action sequence are very quick, and it's just sort of, you know, it's more of a beat than a whole sequence with beats, with action beats in it. You know what I mean? There's no car chase. There's, you know, you're running for 10 steps and then the wolf catches you and then that's it.
Yeah.
So.
And then you slowly die.
Yeah.
Liam Neeson was also in the A-Team.
Yes, he was.
And he was also in this.
Yes, he was.
Fun fact of the podcast.
That's what we're here to bring you, the trivia that nobody else can tell you. So.
How do you like Liam in this?
Love him. I think he's really, really great in this movie.
I do too. And I'm really not nuts about this movie. I think I've kind of said a lot of very, very positive things.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think this is the role for him, though.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great role for him. And I think part of what makes it so interesting to me, this movie, and part of the, like, did you read that Bradley Cooper initially had this role?
Yeah, I did. Also in the A-Team. Double fun fact!
Yeah. That really surprised me when I read that, because...
It seems like such an old person role.
No, and it's not even that. It seems like such a Liam Neeson role because, the first time I saw it, I remember thinking this movie was probably something that Carnahan had in his head. I know it's based on a short story or something that Carnahan came across, a script that he could have had that he came across during the A-Team or at some point in the production on the A-Team, maybe towards the end of the post as he's looking for a new gig. And then... just because, you know, he's in close quarters with Liam Neeson, whose wife died in 2009. And it's just, I think it's just such like a personal, his wife being Natasha Richardson, I believe her name was. Yeah. Natasha Richardson.
Yeah.
She died in 2009 in like a skiing accident. And I think it's just like, this is a movie of him dealing with his wife's death. And I think that's really, really intense to sort of put that out there, and really admirable. And I feel like you get more emotion in this performance than you do from a lot of other Liam Neeson performances. I just feel like he seems wearier, and I don't know. I just feel like he really owns the role.
Yeah. No. When I heard Bradley Cooper, I was after I'd watched the movie, and it just seemed like such a misfit. And I don't know, maybe just because I thought Liam Neeson was so good in it, but I mean, it just seems like that character has to be like the old wise person.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess you can be just the young badass who's so good at what you do, and that would have been Bradley Cooper.
Yeah. That makes more sense out of one thing that I hate about this movie, is the clearly drastic age difference between his girlfriend and him. You know what I mean? That's glaring, you know?
Yeah. When they showed her face at first, and you don't really, I mean, you see her face when he's writing the letter a little bit, but you don't get, kind of the context of their relationship.
Yeah.
I was like, is that his daughter? That's pretty young. Is that Carey Mulligan? What's happening here?
Exactly. And that woman appears to be in her 30s, you know, but still, Liam Neeson's, what, like 58 when this movie was made? So, yeah. I mean, he doesn't, you know, he's a good-looking 58-year-old, but also, you know, you tend to not see the very wisdom-filled men with the younger ladies, you know?
Yeah, no, for sure. this movie has, and this is a bold statement, another bold statement for me today. One of my favorite uses of the term motherfucker in film.
Okay.
the first time he sees the wolf, any wolf eating that guy.
Yeah.
And like, you haven't seen him do anything really badass yet. You've seen him be very depressed, almost killing himself. You've seen him like buckle his seatbelt on the airplane, but you don't really get a grasp of how hardcore he is.
Mm-hmm.
And he sees a wolf. He's kind of, I think he's out taking a piss, or he's kind of out on the perimeter of the camp they've set up.
Yeah.
And he sees a wolf eating a body, and there's just this like moment of stillness, and you don't know if he's going to pull some like, you know, crazy wolf knowledge out of his head to do something like, you know, nuts that none of us would think of because he knows wolves and that's his job and his whole life and stuff.
Yeah.
And he just yells, "You motherfucker," and jumps on the wolf and just starts punching it. Like, I was expecting something so much more clever. He just says, "You motherfucker," and just pounces on the wolf and just starts beating it.
Yeah. No, that's true.
Like, it just seems so out of character, this, like, you know, calm, collected, wise old man.
Yeah,
drops an MF bomb, dives into it face first.
And I think that is the most illogical thing he does in the movie.
Oh, yeah, I think so.
Like, by a wide margin.
Yeah, there's a couple of questionable survival techniques in this movie.
What are your other ones?
Well, I don't know. Again,
if you make fun of the bang stick, I am coming to wherever you're recording and beating the crap out of you with a bang stick.
Okay, well,
hilarious.
I like the idea of the bang stick. Yeah. He throws away his gun that is not beyond use right at the start.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I'm not Bear Grylls here. I feel like you stay with the plane for at least a bit.
Mm-hmm.
They don't bring any like sharp, jagged metal. They don't have any pointy, jabby sticks. That would be step one for me, is a knife on the end of a stick so you don't get near the wolf, instead of a 3-inch switchblade.
Mm-hmm.
But whatever. I'm, you know, not an expert on this, so I'm not going to go too deep, but I just thought there were some questionable survival techniques.
Yeah. I just think
getting wasted. That one seemed obvious, but he didn't partake in that.
Yeah, and I don't think anybody, I don't know, nobody's ever noticeably wasted. They talk about they've got enough to get drunk two times, but I don't know. I don't see any evidence of drunkenness.
They drink, though.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the worst thing you can do in the cold.
Yeah.
And alcohol is flammable, which you could use to make fire. And he has like half a thermos of jet fuel.
Yeah.
As fuel. So.
Yeah. I'm aware of that, but whatever. I do like the scene where he's explaining the bang stick, though, where people are like doubting him, and he's like, it'll work. it's like a bang stick. And I'm like, what's a bang stick? You know, like he says that like it's a pre-existing thing that people know about. You know?
Okay. I thought I was on the outs there, and I was like, okay, that's a thing people know, I guess. Yeah, I don't know what the fuck that is.
And just the way he says it, I find so funny. Like, I'm not sure if that was supposed to be a joke or not, but I take it as a joke every time. Just like, it's a what? It's like a bang stick. Like, you don't understand what
I'm saying. Yeah, maybe that's him just knowing he knows more about all this kind of shit than everybody.
Yeah.
And just going at it with confidence. Like, yeah, it's a bang stick. Like, duh. Yeah. Hoping no one will call him out on, what the fuck is a bang stick?
Yeah, I feel like you're being really kind to the movie there.
But, yep. Yeah. Here's what I've learned, I think, between Taken and how much people loved Taken.
Yeah.
Because that movie was, like, so well loved.
Yeah. It's a really, really good execution of a B movie, and people will always love those types of movies.
Yeah, people loved it, and
I mean, we saw the same thing with Fast Five, but continue.
Yeah, well, no, it's not that I didn't think, it's not that I didn't understand why people would like Taken. It's just I was again, because I didn't see Taken for a little while.
Yeah,
and I heard how much people loved it, and I was like, really? For that movie? Okay, but it just kind of surprised me.
And then your co-podcaster was finally like, enough of this shit, we're watching Taken. You're welcome. But continue with your point.
Yeah. And so after watching Taken, and I mean, what's the big famous thing from Taken is...
Okay, dart strikes.
Well, that and. You know, the talk when his daughter's under the bed, like, this is what's going to happen.
Oh, yeah.
They're going to take you. That whole part. And then him talking to the taker, I guess.
Yeah.
Immediately after, like, the I'm gonna find you, blah blah blah. I think people really love, and this movie added to this and really made this theory clear for me. People love hearing Liam Neeson be like violently honest with people. Like, just telling them what the fuck is going to happen, even if it's awful, awful news. Because we get, I think, three of them in this movie, and I wasn't even keeping score, but just looking back, that's what I thought. Right when the plane crash happens, you're going to die now.
Yeah.
That's what's happening. You're going to die. And then when the guy starts looting all the wallets from the dead bodies, in the next 5 seconds, I'm going to start beating shit which I love.
Yeah. And it's so quick. It's like, in the next 5 seconds, I'm going to be.
Like, that sentence takes 5 seconds. You really have to make a decision quickly.
Yeah. I think the scene on the plane when he tells the guy he's going to die, I think that's a really good scene. And that's not, like, it's sort of a twist on how you normally see somebody certainly about to die. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, he's still like, you know, the light's going to come over you, and it's a very sort of stereo, like, you know, movie version of describing death to somebody that's about to die. And which obviously he has no proof of, you know, and that he is alive. He has no proof that he's right. But just, you know, he's just saying this very calm and confidently, like, this is going to happen and you just have to accept it so that your last minute is okay. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I like that scene a lot. I think it's good.
Yeah, no, and I think it's good, and it does a quick job of establishing him as kind of a very cold but caring person at the same time, like, very fact, reality-oriented, but still, you know, aware of people's emotions, and as awful as that scene is, like, that's a very uncomfortable, painful scene, at least to me, you kind of do get that exposition of his personality that, you know, he does have a soft side. Even in this horrible moment, he wants you to go out in, you know, a positive way.
And yeah,
we get that when everybody else dies for the rest of the movie, pretty much. But you know, you hear it in a bunch of different ways, you know, let her take you there, who do you love, all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
That first, you know, death there, I think, was pretty effective.
Yeah, absolutely. Why don't you tell me some of the things you didn't like about this movie? Because there seem to be plenty of them.
Maybe not that many. Some of the survival stuff. Some of the... I don't know. I think I'm still on the fence about some of the vague philosophy stuff.
Okay. Okay. I will put it very succinctly about how I feel about that. I like everything that doesn't deal with religion.
Go ahead.
I feel like the only parts where things feel sort of tacked on is the religion and not fully, fully formed. I feel like, very much like the, all the stuff that remains in the human realm, I think, is very good. But all the discussions of sort of faith just don't work for me. And I mean, they work in a way that I'm okay with forgiving them, and the movie still like has a lot of impact for me. But just as on a purely writing level, they just don't work. I feel like the filmmaking in those moments is good enough that not only do I forgive them, but that it just really, really works. Like, I think I like that shot of the neon cross just because I think that's a really gorgeous shot at the very beginning. And I feel like that sequence as a whole, like his opening monologue, voiceover while he's in the bar, all that stuff, I think that's just really effectively put together that I'm fine with the cross. You know what I mean?
I see that. And I think that, I don't know, I was kind of watching this movie at first and it does kind of come together really quickly to a point where I was like, is this forced? Like, okay, he's this depressed this quickly. Like when you do a suicide attempt that early, mm-hmm. it kind of seems a little heavy handed. And then, the religion thing is, I think, the part that I struggle with the most. Not that I dislike it, but I really still do have a hard time deciding on how I feel.
Anytime somebody yells at God, like yells at the sky at God, it's not a good thing. You know, like, just for your movie, you know, just don't do it. Don't put it in the script.
Yeah, okay.
That yeah.
So this movie was... they marketed it towards Christians specifically. Now, not only towards Christians, obviously. You want everyone you can to see this movie. But they put together a little companion like piece to read along with this movie and to like take your Christian group to this movie. And, you know, here are a couple points that you can discuss after the fact.
I didn't know that.
It surprised me.
Yeah, I'm very surprised to hear that.
Because parts of it seem... this is honestly where I'm still struggling with this movie. I know how I feel about it as an enjoyable movie to watch, but as far as reading it, there are parts of it that seem very Christian and there's parts of it that seem very atheist. And I don't think that Joe Carnahan or the person writing this movie...
Joe Carnahan co-wrote. But...
Okay, yeah. And I just forget the name of the other guy at the moment. I don't think they...
Ian McKenzie Jeffers.
There it is. I knew it was three names. Oh, almost three first names.
Yeah.
I don't think they went into this like, hey, let's convert people to Christianity or hey, let's convert people to atheism. But as you said, I mean, they deal pretty directly at some moments with the idea of God. As you said, calling him out. I mean, there's no more direct address of this issue, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And sorry, continue.
No, go ahead.
I feel like this is a very existentialist movie. Because he gets no sign from God when he calls out to God. And I feel like that's sort of like the definitive point. It's like he gets no sign. He continues walking and then he's just sort of in the den. You know what I mean? And it's just sort of all he has left to protect him is himself. And it's just sort of like just the individual. You know what I mean? And it's also, by the end of it, it's existential. But I suppose there is a lot of like group stuff in the movie. And it's sort of, it's like, I think this is... a movie that, like, an atheistic movie at its core.
And that's kind of, I think, the most obvious way to look at it. I mean, he calls it for God.
Thank you for calling my criticism obvious.
No, but I mean, it's without taking it too deep. And I mean this, you can read into it. Yeah, I don't mean the obvious. I just mean you can read into most things whatever you want.
Yeah.
If you're a hardcore Christian, you can watch pretty much anything and take a Christian message out of it. And I think on the surface, this does appear to be, you know, more atheistic than anything. Just because of that one scene where we discussed. He calls out to God. He gets no answer. We never really see him get a lot of favors in this movie.
Or best case scenario, the answer is that God led him to the wolf den, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that's, you know, if you don't want to inject your own meaning into it, on the surface, I think that's how you take it.
Mm-hmm.
There is a scene where he directly addresses God and gets no answer. And he goes through this pretty horrible experience.
Yeah.
And I've just been reading a lot of debates from people on either side, you know, and some Christians say, oh, but that's how God is. That's not how he works. You can't just call out on him when you need a favor and that's what happens.
Yeah.
But there's just definitely spiritual and I think existential is a very good word for it, the one that you used. It's quite possible to believe that these wolves aren't just meant to represent wolves in this movie.
Yeah.
There's so much more going on, the way that they talk about love and family and, you know, just what else is happening, that it's, you know, there's definitely a lot to be read into it. And I don't think it is explicitly one way or the other, but I can see how people can take it both ways.
Yeah.
And I think that, I don't know, to me at least, and maybe this is just reading into my beliefs, it comes off as more atheist than anything.
Yeah, I think.
More hopeless than anything.
Yeah, no, to put it bluntly, I'm totally shocked that this is marketed towards Christians. I do think it does really value the group. And I mean, that's a big part of the movie. The only reason he's alone at the end is because, you know, the group has sort of died, but they've died together in a way, you know?
Exactly. And even when Diaz goes, he's become part of the group.
Yeah, exactly.
When he accepts his death, he says, you know, this is the end of it for me. But it seems like everybody accepts that there's something more than just the situation that they're in.
Yeah.
Slightly spiritual to me, you know, like it's not just, oh, okay, well, I've died in the woods. That's how my life ended. They seem to take some solace in the fact that, and this is a big thing for Otway, Liam Neeson's character, is, you know, you're not alone even when you're dying alone. I mean, you know, you can be with these other people spiritually as though there is kind of something to the other world there. And how much we see of him, you know, with his wife.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like there is, you know, some ammo for a Christian to say, like, look, this really is about, you know, Christianity and believing in God and even just being a strong person and having faith in that. And that's what you can take from it.
Yeah. And I mean, I feel like those, I don't know. It's hard to explain. Cause there are like very basic Christian values, but those basic Christian values are also like the most sensible basic Christian values, like, value others, you know, like don't be alone and depressed all the time, you know, that just makes sense on a totally human level that have nothing to do with God. It's just sort of, you know, just find somebody you love and then try and be with them.
Go ahead.
And everybody, you know, everybody in the group has kids except for Diaz. Diaz is sort of supposed to represent, like, he's the one person that doesn't fall in line at the beginning of, with the group. Even that guy who's annoying on the plane, I forget his name, but who annoys...
Flannery?
Yeah, something like that. I don't have any reason to not agree with that. But anyways, as he's annoying Otway and then sort of gets annoyed, it seems like he might be the person that would fall out of line with the group. I mean, he dies early, but until that point, he's just very, he falls in line with the group, and Otway is very clearly the alpha, and Diaz is sort of almost like, you know, it's sort of a doppelganger, but sort of the miscreant doppelganger. He doesn't fall in line, and he's just sort of, until I guess Liam Neeson, his character, trusts Diaz by handing him back the knife, even after they fought, then they sort of, he sort of falls in line, and then that's how he sort of gets to his spiritual end. He sort of, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, that absolutely.
And I mean, the key to that is they're both named John when they reveal their first names, you know?
Yeah. And at the end we get, Henrik's name is Pete. I mean, we get biblical names throughout this movie, which,
yeah, that's true. Again, I never went to church, so these are the things you would know.
Yeah, but I mean, John and Pete are, you know, biblical names, disciples. But yeah, just to go back to something you were saying before, I mean, these are just kind of human, very basic human needs and desires. I mean, Christianity by no means has a monopoly on groups or communities or love or faith or family or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what I mean by, you, if you have one set opinion on faith and spirituality, I think this movie can absolutely play into it, because it is vague, but it does address issues at the same time.
Yeah.
But not saying, hey, this is how you have to think and feel about it. And I don't know. I think that's, I think that's why it has so much debate. And I think that's why, is one of those things why I say this movie had more going on than I expected it to.
Yeah.
It doesn't specifically outline, you know, very intellectual points that I'd never heard discussed, but it at least, you know, can prompt I don't know, we probably did 15 minutes on it just now of that one factor. So yeah, it's got to be saying something.
Yeah, absolutely.
I read a review that I appreciated by, I'm probably going to pronounce this wrong, but Siobhan Sinnott of The Scotsman.
Okay.
He gave the film 2 stars and said, on the downside, I'm just cutting off the first part of this. On the downside, there's a lot of dull, pretentious philosophizing about the heartlessness of nature and God. On the upside, you get to see a man punch a wolf in the face. And that's, I mean, it is, yeah, we've talked about it. It is kind of just an action movie like that, but it's a little bit more. And if you're kind of, that's the way you look at it, like, you know, Siobhan here is, I think a lot of people took away that this, because it's kind of a mainstream Hollywood American movie, that anytime the issue of faith or Christianity is brought up in any terms, it seems like they're trying to force it on you.
Yeah.
And clearly he's not a fan of that.
Okay. Yeah. I don't even know if this can technically be classified as a Hollywood movie. It's pretty much an independent by the looks of the distribution and studio.
Oh yeah.
As far as like, I mean, the line between Hollywood and independent has gotten so,
very blurry.
Vaguely defined. Yeah, exactly. Blurry. Over the past, you know, 15 years or so, but yeah, I feel like breaking it down, this might be able to be classified as an independent movie.
Okay. What did you make of the title, The Gray?
See, I knew you were going to ask me this question, so I thought about it.
I'm obsessed with movie titles, apparently.
No, it's just sort of like...
Can't tell by all the articles I sent you that are about movie titles.
No, it's just sort of, you're more interested in words, and I'm more interested in the filmmaking. That's just how it is, you know?
Yeah.
We all have our things, and... the gray area, you know. I put a little bit of thought into it, but assumed you would have something for it, so I'm just gonna let you say what you think about it.
I'm just going to assume that you asked me this question waiting for you to speak and go with it.
Well, I also just don't have anything, you know.
Yeah, no, it's the color of Liam Neeson's hair.
Oh, okay.
Case closed.
Explained.
No, I mean, I guess there's a few different takes on it. They're all pretty broad, and I certainly don't have a definite answer on it. But I mean, just to go with the religion thing a little bit, or the spirituality thing, some people have said that it's purgatory. I mean, the area between, you know, white heaven and black hell, is purgatory. These guys are kind of, they're stuck in this position, they're stuck in this place of kind of limbo until they accept their death. Most of these people, as you know, as we said, Otway kind of talks them into it and says, you know, go to that place, accept it, let her take you there, whatever. And we see it the best with Diaz, and I think I meant to mention this earlier, I think that's a very nice shot too, when it's just the three of them left, Otway, Henrik, and Diaz, and he kind of accepts that it's not gonna, he's not gonna make it any further because his knee or his ankle, whatever it is.
Yeah, it seems to be both a combination of knee and ankle.
Yeah, he said knee for a while, then he says ankle last. So
it seemed like the way he falls, that's very easy to hurt both your knee and your ankle. Yeah,
that's a tough fall.
Yeah.
But yeah, he accepts death at that point, and he says, I'm not afraid. And we get, he sits on that log, and we get that really nice shot of him kind of looking out on that bay. And it seems like a wolf is about to sneak up on him. At least that's how I took it. The camera kind of slowly creeps up on him at the last minute.
And there's a very clear wolf sound effect.
And you hear some... Okay, yeah. I didn't know if that was just some other sounds or if that was a wolf nearby.
Yeah, it's pretty clear he's about to get ate.
Okay. And so, yeah, he says, I'm not afraid anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, if you're going to look at it from the purgatory angle, that's him saying, you know, he's accepted it. That's the end of things. Now you can go to where you were meant to be. You have no more unfinished business.
Mm-hmm.
And just the other one is kind of, you know, right and wrong. There's kind of that area in between. Otway is going to commit suicide at the start of the movie. That's not usually seen as a very positive act.
Yeah.
It's usually viewed as kind of a selfish act, no matter what position you're in, just because of the people around you. And you've always heard the term moral gray area. I think a lot of these guys are kind of dealing with that throughout the movie.
Yep.
And also the gray area between human and nature, I think, is another kind of middle ground that this movie deals with. Yep. They get kind of animalistic at one point, especially Diaz cutting the hat off that wolf.
Yeah.
And, you know, he gets on his hands and knees and howls back at them and things like that. Yeah, that's something you see often in the adventure or survivor genre of things, that kind of what makes us man, why are they so different, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the gray is, I don't know, I think it's a very effective word. And I mean, this movie is very visually gray.
Yeah.
We get that. The wolves are gray. A lot of the shots are gray of the landscape. All jokes aside, Liam Neeson is pretty gray.
Yeah.
A lot of gray clothing and things like that.
It rhymes with the word fray in the poem that's repeated a couple times.
Yeah, it did. How do you feel about the poem?
I think it's so effective.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I thought you wouldn't like it for some reason.
Nope. Totally fine with it. And even, like, pro the poem.
Okay. Yeah. Wow, that's surprising to me.
Because I think, and again, this goes back to, okay, well, here's one thing that really sums up how I feel about the parts I don't like about this movie.
Okay.
Because, sort of taken on its own, I think.
Taken!
Yeah. anyway, taken on its own, the way Diaz is telling the story about the, I think he's talking about the last person he had sex with. I can't remember for sure if that's what he's talking about.
Yeah.
But it sort of goes into Liam Neeson talking, or Otway talking about his father. That transition is so awkward. But like 3 to 4 words into Liam Neeson's monologue about his father, and just the way they're putting it together, the music, the score there is so good. It's one of like 2 times in the movie they use piano, the other time being the very end. Or, you know, noticeably use piano. And it's just like, he's just sort of, I don't know, he seems sort of so lost. And they're shooting him over the fire, which adds sort of like this little effect over his face from the fire. And the fact that his face is kind of out of focus in the shot. And just all those flashbacks to his dad. And as he's, you know, just in Liam Neeson's voice, you know, he's like probably one of the 4 most pleasant voices in the world. Or 4... I mean, not necessarily pleasant, but just enjoyable voices. I would love to listen to him tell me a bedtime story or something. You know? Like, it would just be the most soothing thing. But anyways, like, it's just, and he's just such a good actor in this movie. And I don't know, the way it all comes together just totally works. And it's sort of like, I feel like this is an action movie directed by Terrence Malick. Like, if Terrence Malick made an action movie, this is what it would look like.
If they said, here is your script, you can't change that much, and you have to do this in under 2 hours.
Yeah.
Do it.
It's got all of Malick's themes. It's got religion. It's got respect for nature, you know, like the divide between humanity and nature.
Yep.
And like you said, it's very religious. I feel like the movie would be less atheistic if Terrence Malick made it.
Yeah.
But it's just, and the way it's shot, and the way they cut in those, you know, like during the monologue I'm talking about, the flashback scenes are very sort of like softly lit and just sort of like pleasant colors to look at. Sort of like very, sort of brown and greenish tones. And yeah, just sort of the way that particularly the monologue at the beginning doesn't sort of follow narrative rules. It's just sort of shots that work and flow together, but just don't follow a line that would, that sort of fit in your traditional narrative film. And I feel like that's very Malickian. The close-ups in this movie aren't the way Terrence Malick would do close-ups. The close-ups in this movie are awesome. Like, I mean, it's just like above the chin and up to the eyebrows, and it's just sort of like the third part, like the right, but only a third of the screen is the face, and then the background's out of focus. Like, I think that shot is so good, and Liam Neeson has such an interesting profile as well. But
yeah, no, I was gonna say, in that the part where he tells that story is really short when he talks about his dad.
Yep.
But I think I remember every shot of that, and I saw this movie once.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, pouring the glass when he's like, oh, you know, Irish family drinker. Like, it's all very brief.
Yeah.
But you do get a sort of well-rounded idea of this past very briefly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the shot of little Otway on his dad's lap, and I don't know, maybe this is good casting or they shot it well, but you see that dad's face and you kind of see that coldness to it, but that softness at the same side, where he talks about how poetry was so important to him.
Yeah.
Like, for a movie, like, again, I've said this before, but just expecting very little from this movie, they round out the characters pretty well.
Yeah.
And I think in that one, that little flashback sequence there where he makes his little speech about the poem that his dad has framed on the wall, I think that in a very brief amount of time, and as you said, coming out of a very awkward transition and then getting back into the movie very quickly as well,
mm-hmm.
I think that's pretty thick.
Yeah, and again, the last 2 minutes of this movie I feel are equally effective and also surprisingly quick. I think but still so effective. I think the way the last 2 minutes of this movie are put together is so, so perfect to me.
He gets into the den?
Yeah, basically. And he's looking at the wallets, and then we go back to his wife, and then, you know, he mounts up for the fight. God, it's so good. And the music, again, it's the same theme from with his dad, and I think it's great.
Yeah. So you're totally okay with the ending of this movie?
Yes. I would be more okay with it without the post-credit scene.
What bugs you about that then? Because it's so ambiguous that it's hard to take offense to, I find.
Yeah, I guess. I just feel like it's sort of... Okay, well, the ending of this movie, when it cuts to black, that's ambiguous. The post-credit scene is, look how ambiguous we can be. That's what they're saying. Yeah.
You still don't know what happened.
Did you miss how ambiguous we were? You know, it's like, I don't know. It's weird. But yeah, I don't love it, but whatever. It's fine.
Okay.
So, I do love that last 2 minutes, though, and I love the cut to black. And not just because it's a cut to black. I know we've talked about it a lot recently with Nolan, but yeah, I just think I think it's super effective. The way the shot of his face, as it's just sort of his eyes, like there's just sort of this noticeable turn in his eyes right before he takes off. It's amazing.
So ready to go.
Yeah. And like, it's just, I don't know. It's so, it has to be such a subtle movement that just looks so defined when you see it. Like it's, cause you know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know. It's just crazy to me. But
with very little description, I do know what you're talking
exactly.
about.
Like, that's how good it is. And I'm sure if you, like, I assume everybody listening to this that's seen the movie knows that, knows what I'm talking about, too. But
so my understanding is that they did film that fight sequence, though.
Yeah, I think Carnahan said he was never, ever going to use it, though.
Why film it?
I think maybe to show your investors that it exists. Could be sort of like... Because, I mean, if you think about it...
It's harder to sell it to people when you say it has this ending and less action and the big climactic fight scene with the main boss doesn't happen.
Yes, exactly. And then I feel like in the pitch meeting, that would be a problem. And then, yeah. And I mean, it's so easy to still shoot that and just have it and never use it. But you can show it to the studio and be like, look, this is a bad idea. This is what it looks like with it, and this is how good it looks without it. You know, like, so.
How do you think the wolves look in this movie, though?
I mean, it's a low budget movie. They don't look great. Like when it's a wolf, they look good. But when it's CGI, they don't look so great.
When it's a wolf, it looks like a wolf. Mm. When it's not a wolf, it doesn't.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's a very low budget movie. I was surprised. Like, I looked it up, and it was a 40-day shoot. I was really surprised.
Shoot, 25 million. That's little.
Yeah, I was 40 day. I was expecting like 30 or less days because there's so much that looks like it's shot in natural lighting. That's another thing, another Maliki thing that made me think of. But yeah, and just like scenes lit by flame or that appear to be lit by flame, like grainy footage, which again, I have no problem with. You know, it just sort of feels like just a really quick shoot. And I guess 40 days is quick for an action movie, but yeah. I felt like it was quicker. And that's no way as a negative about this movie.
Yeah.
And also, why would you want to stay in the cold that long?
In BC, not Alaska.
Yeah. Liars.
Okay. I have one more thing, but that seems... kind of finalizing.
Okay. Well, okay, like, here's this thing about the thing I find interesting about Neeson in this movie. He's sort of like this very old school man, right? And I mean, we've been talking about the roles he's been taking in the past few years as sort of just this badass action guy, but it's sort of like this more humane action hero, you know, like very early on in this movie, he admits to being scared in that conversation with Diaz. And yeah, like,
which I like, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, yeah, which is totally normal, logical, yeah. And,
yep. And unlike an action hero of modern times.
Exactly. And unlike an action hero, period. And, you know, except for like the John McClane types of action heroes. But yeah, and it totally humanizes him. And it's sort of like Neeson is this really large man. I feel like he's probably like 6'4". He's like very broad shoulders. I assume when he walks into a room, it's sort of like, it's a noticeable thing that this person is in the room. Not even if you know he's a celebrity, but just sort of like, he's just a presence, you know? And again, with his voice, he's got his very like manly voice. But he's also sort of like, he's very humane and human, and particularly in this movie. And I don't know. I feel like he's sort of like, he is the action. He's the modern action man. Like, he's still a very manly person, but he's sort of, with the way men have, you know, been allowed to become more emotional over, you know, the last couple of decades, particularly the last decade, I suppose. It's just sort of like, he's still a very old school man, but he's more upfront about his emotions, which is, you know, a very modern male thing, or a thing that is now okay in modern male society, I suppose.
Or in film, at least.
In film, at least, and I think it's more accepted in society in general.
Okay.
As film goes, I think a lot of society goes as well.
Yeah.
I just found that interesting.
Yeah, no, I see that. I mean, the 80s, I guess, was the epitome of, you know, robotic male action hero.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that in just the Terminator way, but in like a Rambo way, it was supposed to be a very cold, unfeeling thing. And even when the catalyst of any violence was like, oh, you've hurt my wife or my daughter, it seems like, okay, that sensitive thing triggered this, you know, uncaring, you know, killing machine to come out.
Yeah.
And whereas with this, we kind of see throughout this, you know, every time someone around him dies, that soft side still comes out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Life is important in this movie. I had a question for you.
Sure.
Okay. Towards the end, when we get that shot of his wife and we get the shot that, you know, somebody is hooked up to something, you know,
yeah,
a drip. What is your take on that?
My take is she is being euthanized or is just dying of a disease and maybe on painkillers or something.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's another thing that is up in the air for me 100%. And I certainly have no definite answer to, and kind of played into the, purgatory idea a little bit, in that maybe he died before we see him at all in this movie.
Yeah.
And that, you know, him being in the gray, him being in this feeling of purgatory, he hasn't accepted his own death at any point.
Yeah.
And even when he's fighting this wolf, he hasn't, even when he's face to face with an alpha wolf, you know, no accompaniment, no guns, no bang sticks, no nothing left, he's still fighting. He still hasn't accepted that, okay, I'm done for. And that he, even after this fight scene with the wolf, is still going to be in the, you know, quote unquote, the gray.
Okay. Yeah, see, and like 5 minutes into the movie when we first see her, what did you think? Like, was there sort of any thought about his relationship to her in your mind? Like,
in all honesty, and this is going to sound like, you know, I'm trying to sound smarter than I am, I thought they're setting it up that they broke up, because in the letter he was saying, oh, I know we can't be together, but it seems like they kind of frame it in this, like, she dumped him, or like he cheated, or she's married now or something like that. And that they were done for, but he kind of wanted her back.
Mm-hmm.
And my honest feeling, swear to God, the first time through was they're going to set it up like they just broke up and he wants her back. But by the end of the movie, we're going to find out that she's actually dead and that they're going to be together.
Okay. See, my thought, and I mean, I only thought, anyways, the first time through this movie, like instantly upon seeing her, I assumed she was dead. And I
soft lighting and white fabrics. And
I don't know if it even has anything to do with that. And I don't know, maybe this is sort of, just me sort of putting my own ideas in this movie very quickly in that, maybe it's just sort of like that first shot, you know, I assume it's them in the bed. Well, I guess that's the only place we see her. Right. It's that, shot in the bed, and it's just sort of like I just for some reason knew she was dead, and then maybe I was just sort of putting the Natasha Richardson thing into it already, and then just being like, wow, this is a really personal thing for Liam Neeson to be doing.
Yeah.
Or something. But I just remember like only today did I ever think that there could be another possibility that she's not dead at the beginning of the movie, and I was just curious how other people experience this movie, because I remember like the first time watching it just being like, oh, she's dead, okay. And, like, obviously it's very wide open. Like, I mean, if you pay attention to the movie, which I apparently wasn't doing, it's very wide open for so many different options here. But it's just sort of like I could only take it as her being dead. Yeah,
yeah, and I think that's partly because you knew the Liam Neeson thing.
See, and I think that's something that that's probably something that came to me or that I thought of after seeing that scene. But I still thought she was dead instantly. I don't think I was instantly like, oh, she's probably dead. Oh, that's probably Natasha Richardson. Wow, that's Liam Neeson. You know, I don't think I was like, that's a very personal thing for Liam Neeson to be doing. I don't think that's like me 8 minutes in figuring out like bang, 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 you know. I assume I thought that by the end of the movie, but
yeah, I think I don't know. I kind of got a notebook feeling about it.
Okay.
Which was, you know, because I think just the way that they show that IV near the end, eventually when she's in the hospital, it seems like a reveal to me.
Oh,
like,
it definitely does. And the music, the instant you see that that drip is when a piano note hits, and it's the first piano note we've heard in a while. And like it's a big like bang, you know.
Yeah, and it seems like
again, my music knowledge comes out. They continue.
your musical and religious knowledge are on profile today.
Yep, absolutely.
No, but no, I that's absolutely right, and I felt like that. You know, the way that they really play that up to be a reveal kind of confirmed my beliefs that this death thing was supposed to be new to you as a viewer.
Mm-hmm.
There certainly isn't a lot at the beginning to make you feel like she's alive, because when they do quick flashbacks of just a face and stuff like that, I mean, that's usually death.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
But I feel like they were trying to sneak one by you, and there's just not a lot of ways without them having conversations to show that she's alive with someone else, which would totally negate the whole purpose of that reveal, right?
Yep, absolutely. Just another really quick point that I just forgot to mention, like going back to some of the action sequences that I think are good, you know, despite problems with effects that, you know, you seem to have with the wolves and, I mean, on the cliff scene as well. But I think the cliff scene's really good.
Let's all dim our eyes at once, wolves.
That I think that scene when they're you know, using the rope or whatever to get across the trees, I think that's really good. And the way Dermot Mulroney falls through the trees, I think that's really effective. And there are a couple good sequences like that. They're really, like, obviously in camera and very simple effects that just work so well for me. And just the quick thing I wanted to add, anytime a character with glasses loses their glasses, it terrifies me. I think, like, that... it's one of the most terrifying things. Like, it's something I constantly worry about as somebody that can't see a foot in front of my face.
Without he was already in serious trouble before
exactly.
fell off. But that's what pushes you over the edge.
And it's just like, oh my God, I'm terrified now, you know?
So. Yeah, no, and actually him falling through the branches like that I thought was really good. And
it's great.
When he hits the ground, and it's that moment between him hitting the ground and him spitting up blood.
Yeah.
That got me to like hold my breath for whatever, 6 seconds or whatever. That's good filmmaking if you could get that reaction, like a physical reaction out of someone.
Yeah, it's just it's because he looks a little bit like Robert Downey Jr. You don't want Dermot Mulroney to die.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No. I think Dermot Mulroney's good in this movie as well. But I also like when his daughter comes there. I like that.
So we've reached the part of the podcast where we just mentioned points that we forgot to bring up earlier.
Yeah. Well, you said your next thing was kind of final, so I was trying to get all my stuff.
The thing I left on was kind of final.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
Now I just have one point that's really not conclusive at all.
Okay.
This was the first movie to put tweets and Twitter handles from movie critics into the commercials.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
I was like, this is where Twitter is now, eh?
Yep.
Legit.
Yep, that's Twitter.
All right, so that's a big closer. Not the God thing, not the spirituality purgatory.
Yeah, it's good that we got the God shit out of the way in the first 15 minutes.
Yeah.
If you'd like to know more about the Church of the MacGuffin Men, go to themacguffinmen.com, where you can find nothing about religion. We've got pop culture criticism that we post every week. Like, we write articles. We've also got more audio podcasts, more video podcasts. We'll have another video podcast out in a day or two about Drive, the Ryan Gosling movie.
It's time to mention our Twitter account.
Yeah.
That's a good segue.
Yeah. You can follow us at the MacGuffin Men, all one word, Mac spelled M-A-C. So, yeah, be sure to keep checking back with us. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Search us, the MacGuffin Men.
Rate us on iTunes.
Yeah, and rate us on iTunes. Search us on the MacGuffin Men, all one word, just like the Twitter handle. Give us a rating, and that will, you know, make us present to more people. You know, it'll help us get seen by others. And also, you know, share something you like on your Facebook page, or tweet about it, or make us a Pinterest board and pin us, or do whatever it is that you do, but not with a voodoo doll.
Maybe people who haven't met us will listen to us.
Yeah, exactly. Or they'll pin us or something. Just any sort of contact would be nice. Yeah, so thanks for listening, and be sure to check back next week. Thanks.
Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.